So as promised, let's begin with the graph representations. There is this one package called graphs. Let me just restart my kernel here. And a graph is, you probably know how a graph is represented. There are vertices and edges, and there's a number of vertices, and you can, for example, number them, and each edge connects two vertices in a graph. And there are, of course, many different representations of graphs. And I think there are three or four of the main one. One is that you just have a list of vertices and then a list of edges. Each edge is a pair of numbers indicating what vertices are connected. And another representation is where you store neighbors. For each vertex, you store all the neighbors that the vertex has. And another representation would be that vertices and edges are their own objects, and each vertex has pointer to all the edges that are adjacent, and each edge has pointer to all the vertices. And a completely different representation would be, for example, matrices. So the rows and columns are just the vertices, and the entries are just the weight associated with the edge, for example. And depending on what kind of algorithms you want to run, some of these representations can be more efficient or not. For example, you may be able to need to find all the vertices connecting an edge, then it's best if you store them, otherwise you don't need to store that. And in this graphs package, you can choose how to represent the graph. And there's also one representation that kind of combines multiple representations. It turns out if you can use one of these representations to efficiently find something out, then you can also efficiently update all the other representations. So you do a bit more work, but then you have a representation that allows you to do anything. So there are different representations of vertices, and the one I'm using here is called X-vertex. That is a vertex. A vertex is kind of a data structure, and it has kind of a dictionary attached to it that allows you to attach additional information with it. That's this representation. That's a nice one, and I call it tensor. And edge, I use the same thing. In this representation, I think each edge is essentially a pair of numbers or a pair of vertices, and there's also a dictionary attached with it. I called it contraction here. That's probably not a good name. What else could it be? I mean, it sounds like someone pregnant or something, deliver a baby. Would you call it bond? Okay, let's call it bond. Let's do that here. And then the tensor network is just the name. This is then an edge list. This is this representation of tensor and bond, James Bond. And if you can create a tensor network, a graph, via an edge list, and this is an empty array of tensors, an empty array of bonds, and I'm saying this is not a directed graph. The directed and undirected graphs, you know the difference. And a tensor network is not directed. And then let's add a few vertices. And A, B, C are just additional names I give to the nodes that just tensors or something. And then I have three vertices that are not connected. And then I can add edges. And because you have this dictionary, I can set attributes on the edges. And here I set an attribute dim for dimension, something like the bond dimension, which is then 1, 2, 3. And the really cool thing about that package is that one, that you can plot it. And then you get immediately, oh, I'm full screen now. It doesn't work as nicely as I thought it would. Gee, oh, wow, whatever. And you get a nice representation of that. And then, I mean, it probably doesn't work, look as nice as if you manually arrange the layout. But if you have a random tensor network or you want to debug something and have something, you can just plot it and it's nice. And this is a GraphViz package which you need to install additionally. And that is then used. So now let's try to find my window here again. Yep. And this is my attempt to write an algorithm that finds the optimal order to traverse a tensor network, to contract the whole tensor network. I haven't debugged this. This is just some Haskell code, kind of where I thought about it. If you have a tensor network that is linear, then you can find the optimal order in order n squared operations, where n is the number of vertices that you have. And that's a well-known result in computer science. But of course, in a real tensor network, things are not linear. And in the worst case, you could assume that every vertex, oh my God, we need to switch off the sound here. if every vertex is connected to every other vertex, then it's probably exponential in the number of vertices. And I have the idea that you can have an algorithm that is kind of has a small power in the number of vertices. And it just sounded like an interesting thing that I wanted to think about. So I began writing an algorithm. And I think it could look approximately like that. That's about the size you'd get. This is mostly me learning the graph package. And since the code probably doesn't work, we don't need to look at it any further. OK, this was the graph package. If you No, that was a 2D visualization.
Yeah, but if you have like, I don't know, six valid nodes, for instance, it might be easier to visualize in 3D than 2D.
I think the graphics package, what it does, it just tries to arrange them on a plane and then applies an algorithm that connected vertices are closer to each other and non-connected ones fall apart. And there may also be something that it tries to move vertices so that it doesn't overlap between any edges.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that it's actually. So this is not the wave toy that we had last time. And I was trying to reload it. I'm not sure it works. There seems to be something wrong with loading the PyPort package, which takes a long time. Okay, let me skip that part. So this was the scalar wave equation code that we had last time. And we were developing it here in a single module interactively. Of course, if you do it in the real way, you would actually do have a package that you generate and so on. But I think here for experimentation is easier if you do it in a browser. And let me just run the code so that we see whether that works or whether I completely lost all the kernels. Yep, that worked nicely. And we can't display anything. That was the initial condition that we set up. It was essentially a set of standing sine waves. Okay, sorry for the scrolling. Okay, let me try once more to load the blotting package. Let's give it 30 seconds to see whether it comes up. Nothing happens. That's not good. Yeah, usually some warnings or errors come up where it complains about something, compatibility, whatever curly braces, round parentheses used. Okay, let's just stop that. Let's go through the code. So we want to solve the scalar wave equation in two dimensions. And you're familiar with the scalar wave equation. U double dot equals the Laplacian of U. So it bounces around like sound waves, so the waves on the surface of a pond. And we discretize the wave equation on a rectangular grid. We have a set of points at which we sample the solution. And if we want to calculate the derivative, we look at the neighboring points. And then we compare and subtract a solution that's called finite differences. Once you evolve in time, I mean, if you discretized in space, then you're still continuous in time. Then the system has become a coupled system of ODEs. And there are regular integrators that you can use for that. Runge-Kutta type integrators. So for example, a second order Runge-Kutta would be a good approach for that. And here in this code, we start with defining some constants. And I and j is the number of grid points that we have in the I and j directions. And we define the coordinates of the domain, goes from 0 to 1, so it's a square. And dx and dy is the grid spacing. We divide by ni minus 1 because of the typical fence post problem. And dt is the time step size that we are later going to use. There's a state vector, state. There's the information that we store at each grid point. U is the scalar wave, phi. Ut is its time derivative because you have two time derivatives. it's customary to normalize the equation that you introduce variables for all the other time derivatives, but when you write it down, you can write it as an equation that's first order in time. And we do the same in the x direct, so in the spatial directions ux and uy, then we only need first derivatives in space that makes it certain mathematical things easier to treat. Then we have a grid. A grid describes the solution at one time. T is the time at which we are. Start at time t equals 0, then advance by dt. S is the state where we store these four quantities, and each of them is stored in a 2D array of loads. So then we have four arrays for u, ut, ux, and uy. And this is the constructor where we set up all these arrays with the respective sizes, and I and nj. And it's the usual Julia way. You should all be very familiar with that. And then there's the routine in its standing, where we initialize everything for a standing wave at a certain time. We create a grid. We choose some mode numbers, kx and ky, 2 and 3. So we have two wavefronts in the x and 3 in the y direction. Omega is then the corresponding frequency. And then the standing wave that we choose is cosine of 2 pi omega t, sine kxx, sine kyy. And just initialize all the grid using that. That is what we wrote last week, last time, which was, when was that? 3 weeks ago or something, when we met, quite some time. So I was hoping that, say, Jonah or someone would be here, because then he could actually develop the code. But right now, it's probably me developing the code. So let's continue to do that. Let's write down the how to calculate the right-hand side for the scalar wave. No, I think we should do something else first. We should set up a boundary condition. Here in the, do we need a boundary condition? Let's just keep the boundaries constant in time. That should be easy, then we don't need a boundary condition. So let's do the right-hand side, how that looks like. And to calculate the right-hand side, the time derivative of all the fields that we have, we need as input a state vector. And output is then again a state vector containing all the time derivatives. And we don't need any information about time or coordinates, because the wave equation as a PDE is all defined locally. It's independent of the coordinates that we use. So we have a state vector, let's call it G, which is a grid. And then we create a new grid, let's call it R for right-hand side. Do you know the function similar? Oh wait, similar doesn't work, no, similar. If you have an array, this gives you an array with the same size and the same type, and you can also change the size and type. But it doesn't work because we need a grid object. We don't actually need an array. Let's just create a new grid. And the right-hand side, yeah, let's initialize it. So the grid lives at the time t, the right-hand side. Now let's also initialize it to time t, because the right-hand side lives at the same time. So we loop over the whole grid, but we need to leave out the boundary points, because we calculate derivatives by looking at the neighbors of each grid point, and at the boundary, that's not possible. So at the boundary, we're going to have to apply a boundary condition, or we can set the right-hand side to zero at the boundary to keep everything constant. That's probably easier. And then we have at the right-hand side the state vector u of I comma j. So the time derivative of u happens to just be ut. So we can just copy that. Sorry. That is easy. And the scalar wave equation, let me just write it down. Now let me write it down here in the code. Then we can actually repeat it. E by dt of u is ut. E by dt of ut equals d by dx of x plus d by dx of uy. D by dt of ux is d by dx of ut. That's just partial derivatives commuting and the same. Yeah. And this equation here comes from the actual scalar wave equation where you have dd by ddt, a strange syntax. Sorry about that here. This is the second derivative of u and x. And if you replace the second derivatives by first derivatives, you get this equation here. This is just the definition of ut. And here you just permute the first derivatives. And then you get the respective equations that we're going to implement here. And then to implement, now I'm looking at this term here. To calculate the derivative in the x direction, you take one grid point to the left, one grid point to the right, and divide by twice the distance. That's then a finite difference. So this is g, yes, we have ux here, right? I plus 1 minus g, s, ux, I minus 1. Divide by 2 dx. And we need to do the same thing in the y direction. And the other terms are easier.
You're probably using some j's in this line, previous line.
I probably do. So to calculate in x direction, you just look at, you don't move in the j direction. So it's just the same. And here, of course, for the y derivative, we actually need to do that to dx. And for uy, we calculated a derivative in the y direction. And then I said we chose the Riley's with a simple boundary condition. We just want to set the right-hand side on the boundary to 0. So let's do that, and I'm lazy now, so we just use the array expressions. Oof. Yeah, let's do it properly. Let's introduce a function for that. We have a certain array, A, a 2D array, then we set the boundary to a certain value, and then we set e of 1 to the value. Do you know the end syntax in Julia? It's the last one, yes. And you can also write end minus 4 or something. It's a bit strange because end is also a keyword, right, for begin and end. So this is only, this end syntax only works within square brackets. And let's be fancy, because currently we're setting the corner points twice. Let's not do that. So here we're going from 2 to n, what? Let's here go from, instead of doing everything, we're going from 2 to n minus 1. Yep.
The question is kind of unrelated to the rest of it that came to my mind from this end thing. Can I, when I'm indexing arrays, the thing that goes in the square brackets, is that, what is it actually? Because in Python, that's actually a tuple. And I can use all kinds of fun tuple magic to create these indexing objects and just feed it within the square brackets. Can I do something like that here? Like if I wanted to somehow use some algorithm to construct the index.
Yes, you can do that. So this here is a special syntax for a particular function call. And this should be equivalent to the function setIndex, which exists in base for a colon 1. Mm. And of course, if you have end minus 1, that gets translated to the size in the corresponding direction minus 1 and so on. So it's a bit more complicated, that respective layering. But this is just a tuple with 3 entries. And if you want to construct a tuple there, you can do that.
What is the colon object? Is it
it's just a colon. It's just a thing of type colon, actually.
Okay. And what about using end in that set index?
Yeah, look, that is just, hold on, how it's translated. Yeah, end, you have to, if you want to do something else, this would be size of a,
comma 2.
And I would have to use that if I was using set index.
Yes.
Okay.
It's unfortunate that, but that is actually easy on Python, and that's a small thing.
Yes. So this is actually currently under development in Julia 05. In Julia 04, you can also take subarrays. I mean, you have an array and you pick an index range and this one here, and this gives you, well, this is a special set index call, but you can get a subarray. And in current Julia version, by default, it makes a copy. And that, of course, is an expensive operation. And in 0.5, by default, it will give you a view of the original array. And you can, of course, then make a copy from that view, which is the expensive operation. And I think that will make these index operations a bit easier, because then there will be convenient ways to get subarrays or views, subviews, whatever they will be called in the end. So, but of course, yeah, now we need to actually call that Dirichlet of RSU. And zero. Man, it always introduces an empty line. I'm so annoyed by that. So this should work, right? Will it work? Any bugs? Thank you. And we probably also want to return R. And here, every Julia function returns whatever is in the last line. So you need to think about that. And here it probably makes sense to return the array A again or to return nothing. I mean, otherwise it would return that array slice that we calculate there, and that makes no sense. Oh. No. We got rid of the end of this here. Good. Then we calculate initial conditions. Good. And then wave toy right hand side of G. Let's see how that looks like. Okay. So this, you know what? Let's just make the array a bit smaller here. 4x4 or something. Would that work? Let's make it 5x5. And let's this to 1 and 1. And then we can actually look at all these things. Yeah, it still doesn't look good. How can we improve that? R.u, R.ut, R.ux, R.uy. I'm just trying to improve the plot in here. Man, I got so fancy with the type here. No, no, it's just inconvenient actually looking at all these things. Yes, so this is u. Sorry, that's actually plot first the initial condition up here. And now it's all G. Oh, yeah. I should have written a function that displays things that would be easier. So this is U for the initial condition. And you see it's all zero. I mean, the starting point round off essentially zero. And there is UT that is also zero. And we have UX, which has some non-zero points here. And UY has some non-zero points in some other directions. How can, oh no, this is not all zero, Rick.
Yeah.
They're zeros and ones. Otherwise UX and UY couldn't be zero. So UT is zero, and U and the X and Y derivatives are non-zero. And if we look at the right-hand side that we calculated, which is this one here, then we see that actually the right-hand side of u is zero, and that's a good sign because it's supposed to be ut, which was zero up there. And then this is ut, the Olaf variable, and this is non-zero here. There are twos and sixes here. I'm a bit unhappy about that. I expected something that looks a bit more symmetric. So there's probably a bug in the code. And ux and uy are zero, and these should be derivatives of ut, which is zero. These are the right-hand side. The right-hand side of ux and uy is zero because the right-hand side is the spatial derivative of ut, which is zero as displayed above. It would be much nicer to display that in a graphically, but that is currently not working. So let's briefly look through this, whether we spot a bug, but otherwise we're just going to leave it be because that does not seem to be very interesting. UX and UY plus one. Ah, look, equal sign. Oh my God, and there's no error about that, no warning. Not even the audience spotted that. It's disappointing. Right. So let's look at things. And then we have minus 8 and 8, 8 and minus 8, and the remainder is essentially 0. That looks nice and symmetric. Okay, so that could work. We can also implement a time integrator, and that should take another 5 minutes or something. That is not too bad. It's the Runge-Kutta 2 time integrator of G grid. What else do we need? That's all we need, right? Okay, so a Runge-Kutta integrator works the following way that, well, you have the state, you calculate the right-hand side, and then you take the state plus dt times the right-hand side to make an approximation later on, and then you repeat that or do various combinations of right-hand sides in a very particular manner. I'm not going to talk about that, to arrive at a higher order approximation. If you just take the current state plus dt times the right-hand side, that's a Taylor approximation to first order. That's not very accurate. We are going to do something that is second order in the end. Let's call this G0 because that's the original input. And then we have R0 equals is the right-hand side of G0. Then the first approximation is then G0 plus dt over 2 times R0. And of course, this is what we want to calculate, but we haven't defined that multiplication operator yet. So we don't have linear algebra for the grid yet, which is a bit inconvenient, but we can write that later on. And then this is grid 1, then we can calculate the right-hand side for this one. And this is actually then the solution already calculated in this way. And G2 is then the result. Now we need to implement, so it's called a state vector. And you know that functions are vector spaces. So if we store the state vector in an array, then it's a vector space. And for vector spaces, you want to allow linear operations. That is, you want to be able to add, subtract, multiply by a scalar, and so on. And these are the operations you need to implement. So let's just do that here for the grid. Plus and times. Yeah, I mean, you can also implement minus. I'm going to be lazy here. Plus G grid H grid equals, it's already going to be a function because I need multiple lines. Result is a new grid. I just take the time of grid G, which probably should do some checking. Result as u equals g as u plus h as u. That looks good. These are arrays that we can add, right? And now it's a bit tedious because we just need to repeat that for all the elements of the state vector. Julia supports automated code generation, and these parts, I mean, in any simulation code, in particular, if you evolve the Einstein equations, and you're in 3D, not 2D, and you have 25 evolved variables, not 3 evolved variables, then this part of the codes become really tedious. And I hope that in Julia, with macros and automated code generation, that in the future, these things could be simplified. But at the moment, I'm just going to leave it as it is, and just have to suffer through that. Now we also define how to multiply things. Multiplication by a scalar. Alpha is a float, and then the grid, I'm going to call it G. Multiply it by a scalar. Looks good, does it not? Seems correct. Yeah. Okay, I should probably set the time correctly. G2 time equals, can I do that? Well, let's not worry about the time. Let's just try it out. These are the initial conditions and the right-hand side. And now let's try something else. Let's do a time step starting from G. Call it G again. Type is immutable. Okay, I can't do it with an array. Do you understand the error message that appears there? Let me scroll down here. It says type is immutable. In that multiplication operation, and if you look at state, state is immutable. Yes. Yes, probably the easiest. Yeah, I obviously didn't think these things through well enough. Let's just see what happens here. Yeah, there's something. And then we have this nice expression up here that I'm going to copy. If you can actually look at the result. Looks nicer. And since I say G equals RK2, and RK2 does one time step, we now did two time steps. I hit enter twice, and then things should have happened. And the next things would be, for example, to put in an analytic solution and then check in how far this differs from the analytic solution. For a 5x5 grid, it should differ quite a bit. But if you go to 100x100, then it should not differ that much. And since we have vector operations, we can subtract solutions from each other, and then you can nicely plot them. And if you plot them, you don't have just the forest of numbers there, but you can actually nicely see, if you choose the color map correctly, if there's one value that is really bad, because that would be bright white and everything else would be near black. And something else that you can do is you can calculate the energy. The energy of the wave equation is kind of u dot plus u prime or so. And you can calculate that and calculate the sum of the energy that corresponds to the integral of the energy over your simulation domain. And if you look at your boundary conditions, you know whether energy should be conserved, how much energy is injected into the system. And then you can also plot how energy behaves over time. And of course, if energy grows, something is bad. And if it shrinks too quickly, then it's bad. And ideally, it should be conserved in the physical world. But since this is a numerical implementation, there's probably some numerical dissipation in there, so energy should slowly decrease. And the more grid points you have, the better it should behave. Okay. Now, I don't want to continue doing that here, since you're not interested actually in solving PDEs. And I don't think it would make sense without me giving a background into how to discretize PDEs and so on, which I don't think would make sense at this point. Okay. Thanks for the pointer for making the type not immutable. That was a quick and dirty fix. Probably the right way to do in this point. Okay. Do you have further questions to that code? Otherwise, I'd say, since it's a small audience, if you have another topic that you want to talk about, we can do that. But otherwise, we can also call it a day. I mean, it's not really.
Like, for instance, if you have like a time variable and you want to.
Yes, you can do that. Actually. Oh, man. Of course, yeah. So I'm actually working on another project, and you probably realize that the language I'm using here is the wrong language. So if you look at that here, this is the code where I iterate to data sets that are stored on file. So if you have a large simulation running, you probably want to save things to a file, not keep everything in your browser and so on. So this is what I did there. This is in Python, but I can obviously do the very same thing in Julia as well. The same packages exist. So here's some code where I iterate over some iterations that are stored in there, calculate the minimum and maximum, and this syntax here accesses data stored in a file. And it would look very similar in Julia. I mean, here it's percent to insert these things in there. In Julia, you'd write $iter and $c here. You'd use double quotes and so on. But apart from that, it would be the same syntax. And down here is the actual plot plotting. Where is the plotting? Ah, it must be down there. Let me scroll a bit. And it's using the pyplot package, which exists also in Julia via a wrapper. So it's very similar. Where is it? Oh, here, imshow. This is where the image is shown. And then the figure is saved into a file as a PNG file. So you do that for every iteration. And you can also parallelize that, because typically reading data files and creating a figure, a plot, and so on, that can take several minutes if you have to read a large data file. And then if you want to make 1,000 frames for the movie, that can take a long time. So you really want to do it figure by figure in case something happens. And you can also parallelize that. And in the end, you stitch everything together to create the movie. And there are packages for that. And it's just FFmpeg. That's what everybody does. And you can also call convert or something, which will in the end call FFmpeg. And then you create a movie. And these magic strings that you pass, you find them via Google. Now I know that they're necessary in what they're doing, color space conversions and so on, but I would not have known how that works. And down here, rm3, that just deletes the, if I create a temporary file, I like to do that in a subdirectory to make sure I'm not accidentally conflicting if several scripts on at the same time. And rm3 just deletes the whole subdirectory, all the temporary files, all the PNG files. And then the final movie, I should be able to show you the movie. Actually, have you seen Neil's public lecture? It's a similar thing that I'm doing here, except now with a higher resolution. Let's see whether they are here. Is it this one here? Yep, that's the thing. Different color scheme, of course. And then you see the shocks forming here. And well, that was Python, but just today I thought I should do it in Juilliard. And the strange thing, of course, is that, oh, sorry, let me cycle through some others. Do you see the difference between these two pictures? If you look at the color scheme, you will see that one of them has values that are about twice as large as the other ones here. And it's the same simulation, just in a different number of processors. The simulation is written in C++, not in Juilliard. So apparently there's a bug in there. I mean, the values shouldn't change just if you run on more processors. And that's what I've been trying to debug for the past week. I'm very annoyed with at least that simulation set. Yeah, anyway, these are my problems.
Another question. When you make the accidental bug of replacing minus sign with equal sign,
yes.
What did it actually do? Why did it not? Like, that was considered a legitimate syntax. So
it yes. Yes, it did actually what you did. Where was it? Here was one of them.
Yes.
So what it does, I mean, it evaluates this expression by expression. And when it evaluates here, this parenthesis here, it calculates the right-hand side, which is a value. The left-hand side happens to be not a value, but actually an array element to which you can assign something. And then it took this value here, assigned it to the other one. And that was also the return value of the expression. So there were two bugs in there, because one, that array element was modified, and second, it didn't calculate the difference, but you just got one of the values in here. And that's really surprising. I mean, if assignments are expressions, then yeah, it's difficult to spot. I would have expected a warning or something, but well, you get what you get.
I don't know, I had some issues. I tried on Python, and I don't know, it didn't. Because is it the same if you want to do it like several CPUs on the same node, or if you want to use it over several nodes?
If you want to diagonalize a matrix and want to use an algorithm that exists in the library, what algorithm did you use? Was it an LU factorization or
I think I've tried LU at some point.
Okay. So the LU algorithm is implemented in a library that is multi-threaded. So if you want to use one node of Titan with all the 12 cores,
yeah,
then Julia itself you need to run it only in a single core. And only when it actually starts the ALU decomposition, then it starts the other threads, uses all the cores,
yeah.
And then it goes back. And if 90% of the time is in the matrix, in the ALU decomposition, that works perfectly fine and efficient. And the advantage is you don't need to do anything special in your code. But that works only if you use one node. So if you want to use multiple nodes, then things become efficient. Then things become complicated to program.
And then you can use this distributed array, no?
Yes, but I don't know whether the ALU decomposition algorithm can handle that or not. Now, definitely the MKL library that was multi-threaded on a single node, that would not work because that much can't handle it. But there are other algorithms that can use distributed arrays. And what I don't know, but I didn't look up, is if you use a distributed array, whether there's an implementation for that type that would automatically choose the correct algorithm. It seems kind of elegant. One would hope it should be there. And then the ALU decomposition algorithm is probably implemented in Julia, and then based on distributed arrays. So it may or may not work. I don't know. So in principle, one would also hope that if it does a sub-algorithm on the portion of the data that sits on one particular node, that it then switches back to the efficient implementation. That I also don't know.
Very general questions, because you seem to know about the development of the language itself. Is there, what should I expect in the future? Is there a timeline for when 1.0 is coming out? Is there a list of things that are going to be implemented before that?
So no one speaks about 1.0 at the moment.
Okay.
But the plan is to have a release every 6 months or so.
Okay.
Previous release might work took longer than that. And there are several kinds of features that people want. And one of them is multi-threading,
on which people are currently working. And it's obviously huge with multi-core and so on. That's important. And I don't think it will be ready to be used in 0.5, but at least you can enable it, and it will not immediately crash the Julia interpreter, so that people can begin to experiment with it and improve it. And another problem is a technical problem. You know, it uses this just-in-time compiling, this LLVM compiler, and currently it uses LLVM 3.3, which is kind of 2 or 3 years old. And there are various other technical problems why it's difficult to update that. And I hope they can take some time to figure that out and to prove that. And apart from that, one big thing is the arrays. I mentioned that earlier. Change how arrays are implemented internally, and that may also have some user-facing changes. For example, that you don't get a copy but a subarray, that of course will break things.
Yeah.
Because if you just take the subarray and then modify things, you're accidentally modifying the other one and so on. So that.
Do you expect the language to look very different from what it looks like now once it's finally locked down?
No, I think the basic syntax is the same. I don't know what multi-threading will do to it, but if you don't use multi-threading, don't expect major changes.
So there's plans to have multi-threading.
You know, it has multitasking at the moment with async and task and
yeah.
so on. And multi-threading will probably, but that's just my assumption, look similar.
Okay.
That instead of having the tasks, they run one after each other, they kind of run at the same time. But of course, there's lots of problems because you need to have locking and the interaction needs to be right. And it can't be too complicated because then everybody gets it wrong all the time. Just have a very crashy thing that gives randomly wrong results. So that remains to be figured out how that works.
Yeah, I was just thinking, if I end up writing a lot of Julia code now and I come back to it in 10 years, this is a very hypothetical scenario. Is the language going to be completely different?
It's not going to be completely different.
Yeah.
Even computer hardware, how that looks in 10 years, I don't know, with parallel programming. But you see with arrays, when you take a subarray or something, and at the moment it's one way, and then, so I think if you write something and come back to it in a year, you have to brush up the code, you have to clean it and change it. And there are probably instructions on the web helping you to do that. But it's not that you just spent 2 minutes. I mean, you have to understand the algorithm, right? Copying versus non-copying and so on. You have to actually know that. And
yeah.
I think that will be necessary once a year with codes that you have.
Yeah.
And in Python, of course, it's different, right? There's Python 2, Python 3, that one change that happens once every 10 years. In Julia, they still have that once every year. So that's a difference.
But I assume that in some years, that would stop.
Oh, yes, by 1.0, it will stop. But I don't know when it happens. So what I want to see personally is multi-threading. That's the big feature that I'm looking for. And then the language is then for what I need, good enough.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, so then let's close it.
And next week you will present something. Do you also want to present something or not so much?
I can try.
Okay. You don't have to, but if you want a grade for the course, then you need to do a project and do something next
yeah,
year.
Yeah, I have a project,
and
but
register.
I'm just not ready with this. So
if you want, you can just give a 10-minute introduction over the project.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to do anything with Julia. Just tell us what,
yeah, okay.
what you're doing.
I'm probably going to be talking about something that I'm going to look into some of the central libraries.
Okay, I'm going to talk about something completely different. So
okay,
that's fine.
I probably actually, do you know Jutta Hegeman? A tensor network guy from the Netherlands?
No.
Let me switch off the microphone.
Sure, sure. he's one of the central tensor network people, and he's been writing all his code in Julia for the last, I don't know, a couple of years or something.
Really?
So probably